Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 104 for May 26, 2011, the Malibu 500. Watch Autoline After Hours live at AutolineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline After Hours in the iTunes Store. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us. And by us, what I mean, of course, is me and the auto extremist, Peter DeLorenzo, here in the studio with me. Peter, always good to be here with you.
It's great to be here, John, on the pre-Indy Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, we have to explain to everybody, Peter's going to be here for the first part of the show, but then he's going to have to leave because he's heading to the Indy 500. Mm. We'll later be joined with Russ Clark, who's the head of product marketing at Chevrolet. We really want to ask him about this new Malibu that they're coming out with, that they've teased a little bit, and Todd Lassa from Motor Trend Magazine, yeah, too. And they'll join us here in the studio in just a little while, but yeah, Indianapolis 500, the 100th anniversary.
100th anniversary of the race.
That's an awesome statistic.
I mean,
no other race in the world comes close to that, does it?
I don't think so. Now, it's not the 100th running of the race because of the gaps in the war years.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's huge.
They've
been racing there for 100 years at that speedway. And, you know, it did fall into disrepair. It almost... You know, we wouldn't be talking about it today if
Tony Hullman.
Tony Hullman, but I'm trying to remember who talked him into buying. Was it Wilbur Shaw or, I don't know, because Eddie Rickenbacker was involved. But Tony Hullman rescued the speedway after.
Which was just falling apart, weeds growing up on the track.
Yeah, I mean, after World War II, it was really sad. And, you know, he basically just spending all his own money once he bought it to grow it, and here we are.
It's one of the preeminent facilities in the world, really, racing facilities in the world.
I think it is, you know, it's the cathedral to speed. It is the, you know, you have the Nürburgring.
Mm-hmm. The old track.
The old track, and you have Indy, but it's the most compelling and historic facility you can visit if you're a race fan,
right?
I think.
And Monaco, of course, has been around a whole long time,
yeah,
since the 20s, and of course they're running this weekend too.
Yeah, so if there were four big races that we as enthusiasts talk about, it's Le Mans,
right,
Monaco, Indy, and I guess you'd have to say the Daytona 500.
I would say absolutely.
Those four major races, if you're a young driver, that would be, you'd want to win one of those before you hang it up.
So what do you make about this year's race? I mean, the dominant teams, Penske is like, I'm not going to say on the trailer because they're never on the trailer. And then Ganassi blows it completely. Both his cars run out of fuel just trying to qualify.
Oh, man, that was stunning. Well, here's one thing about this year's race that makes it interesting. This is the last year for the Dallara in its current form. Now, remember, this chassis has been around a while. Next year, they go to the new chassis. So this is kind of like the perfect storm where if you've been around the racing game and the IndyCar racing game for a while, you can roll out a car that will qualify very well. And then you saw some things happen. Ryan Briscoe hit the wall on Saturday before qualifying. He had to go to his backup car. Now he's in the ninth row.
Yeah. ninth row of three row apiece, three per row.
11 rows of three. And Elio Castroneves ended up in the sixth row, which was shocking. Now, Will Power came through and qualified in the middle of the second row. But the
but that's only almost barely acceptable.
Yeah.
Especially for a guy who's dominated the whole season so far.
It was the first time in I don't know how many years that a Penske car hasn't been on the front row. It's been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Ganassi thing was just, I mean, they clearly admit they made a mistake. I mean, Daria, it wasn't a pole run, but it was clearly going to be in the first two rows. And he literally runs out of fuel on his, you know, on the fourth lap or the end of the third or whatever. I was stunned.
I was stunned too.
And then
his teammate
Scott Dixon said his car started to run out in four, and now he might have been on the pole.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they were embarrassed, and you know. But we have some great stories. We have Alex Tagliani, who, you know, he
started his own team.
Well, yeah, it's an adjunct of Sam Schmidt Motorsports. Now, Sam Schmidt was a journeyman IndyCar driver who was had a horrible accident in practice 10 years ago, and he's paralyzed now. But, you know, Sam is a great guy and has retained his spirit, and it was great to see.
His spirit, you say, because he's confined to a wheel.
Yeah, he kept his spirit, and he is a good guy, and everyone was happy to see his affiliation with Tagliani, and they got on the pole.
Yeah.
And then Oriel Servio is another story in the third position, and Townsend Bell. And Dan Weldon comes back and gets on the second row. So that part of the race is one thing. You have the end of the life cycle of these chassis. You've got a bunch of people who can muster qualifying runs, but the race is a whole nother deal. You know, you have, you know, a few rookies in here, but you have people like Ryan Briscoe and Marco Andretti and Graham Rahal and Danica Patrick, all in the last three rows. And, you know, the start of the Indy 500 is the most electrifying moment in all of sport, period. It's also the most dangerous moment in all of sport, because if you've ever been in a speedway and, you know, I highly recommend, if you've never been, to go ahead and take the bus tour, because that'll be the only way you'll physically get on the track. And once you get on the track, you are stunned at what you see, because all you can think about is, really? You go 232 into turn one and turn into turn one at 232, and it's...
talking miles an hour, not kilometers.
Yeah, and when you're riding in that bus, you're just like... You gotta be kidding me. And then they put three in a row for the start. It's tough.
Go back to what you were saying, because I find this fascinating that these much smaller teams with much fewer resources have the dominant teams, which are Penske, Ganassi, and Andretti Motorsport.
First time it's happened in years.
And so why is it that these little teams can somehow find whatever it takes to tweak these cars to go real fast, and Andretti's teams, they're all on the back row practically.
Well, Andretti had a horrible, Indy qualifying. They accumulate.
Of course, there's a history of that at Indy, too.
Yeah, they accumulate knowledge. They all have the same engine. You know, the engines are, you know.
Right out of the Honda crate.
Yeah, real close. If they have enough savvy people on their teams and they can get the setup just right and, you know, they can do it. I mean, it's an art. But again, qualifying at Indy and racing at Indy are two different things. As Rick Mears famously said, and I don't know if I got the miles right, but I think he said, I spend the first 400 miles setting up my car for the last 100. Hmm. Something like that. I might get there. But Rick, who I consider the greatest oval racer in history, I mean, AJ's great, Alan's is great, but I thought Rick, six poles at Indy, and he almost won five times. Rick should have been the only five-time winner. I thought he was the greatest oval racer. But that's what he said. You spend the whole race getting ready for the last 100 miles. And, you know, a lot of these racers don't, you know, they're not familiar with that. There are plenty of veterans here. But qualifying is one thing. You know, running 200 laps, running in traffic, making pit stops, you have so many chances to make a mistake.
And not only that, but this year on the restarts after the yellows, it's going to be two abreast.
Yeah.
They've never done an Indy.
Yeah, and boy, the drivers are not happy. And that's still being discussed, from what I understand, down there. They might, I don't know what they're going to do, but a lot of the veteran drivers says that's just a recipe for disaster at Indy.
Because for anybody who's not familiar with it, they usually start single file. But going two abreast, of course, they've done that to try to mix it up, make it more exciting for the fans.
Yeah.
But there is that safety issue.
Yeah.
Like you say, turning into turn one at 2:32, you don't go two abreast.
Well, if you do, it's that famous race when Michael Andretti and Rick had their duel the last five laps, and Michael passed Rick on the outside of one, which was stunning. And I remember the announcers going nuts, and then the next lap, Rick came back and passed him on the outside of turn one again and went on to win. But you bring up a good point. The Andretti Racing Organization had a horrible qualifying.
Terrible.
And not only that, Ryan Hunter-Reay doesn't make the race, and Michael makes a deal with A.J. Foyt to pull Bruno Junqueira out of the car and put Ryan Hunter-Reay in. Now, you know, I got a lot of email about this. This was quite the hot topic. I mean, even Indy drivers were twittering about it, you know, just saying, you know. But I forget who it was. It was either Franchitti or Dixon was basically said, you know, hate to remind everybody, but this is a business.
Not only is it a business, this is not the first time it's happened
it's
by a long
the
stretch.
Time
There's
it
a long history of that. Of course, with 100 years, you can have a long history of everything there. But
is it fair to Bruno? No, but it has happened.
Right.
And, you know, people write in, that means the whole qualifying was a waste. No, it wasn't a waste. You know, you still have the people who went fast.
Well, and again, what people have to remember, because Indy is unlike any other race that I'm aware of, the car qualifies.
Right.
Not the driver.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, if somebody got sick or something, for example, you could throw another driver in the car, no problem. But if there's a problem with the car, you can't substitute it. No.
Yeah,
the car qualifies, not the driver.
And A.J. Foyt will retain car owner points, but Ryan Hunter-Reay will get driver's points for the Indy.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that little wrinkle on it, too.
Yeah. So, you know, it's going to be a most interesting race.
And we've got four women running, and everybody knows Danica Patrick, but you and I have talked a lot about Simona Del Silvestro because
this girl
can drive.
Yeah, she can drive, and I was remiss to mentioning her on the site this week because she had a horrendous crash in practice.
When a piece broke on the car.
And she had her hands badly burned. Well, not, you know, burned. I mean,
second degree.
Yeah, and she said, I mean, it was all she could do to qualify, and which I thought she did a tremendous job. So if she's feeling good, yeah, I think Simona is probably the most talented female racer to come along in a long or ever.
Right.
And
good on both the ovals and the road courses.
Yeah. And Pippa Mann,
I don't know anything about her.
Yeah, she's a young Brit, and I think she's pretty impressive. I know the people on her team are quite impressed with her.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then you have Anna Beatrice, she's been in before. And, you know, Danica runs real well at Indy. So
Danica's a serious competitor.
Yeah, no, Danica, you know, everyone says, well, who's going to win? Well, any one of 15 drivers can win the race, realistically, maybe 20. But I'm just hoping that the first few laps isn't a horrendous, you know, I hope everyone
doesn't crash.
It's
always one of my favorites who gets knocked out, it seems, in those early crashes.
Yeah, it just ruins the race, really. I just hope they can not have that happen and get sorted out, and then you're going to see some drivers just steam into the front. And I thought, you know, Paul Tracy did a great for his team qualifying, and you know he could be a factor too. So everything's
what I find interesting too about Indy is we have what I guess you might call yeoman race drivers. This is the only race in the year that they do.
Yeah,
I mean they do Indy and that's it. And I'm not aware of any other series where you see drivers pop in for just one race.
Well, there's only a few of them this year. Now, Dan Weldon, I think, is going to run some more, but, you know, he's one Indy.
Right.
So, but he's on the outside
Buddy
of Rice. Road. To,
Buddy
yeah.
in for this race, right? And
yeah.
Ed Carpenter, I think that this is the only race he does.
Well, no,
oh,
Ed,
no, no.
Ed is driving for Sarah Fisher, who's pregnant, so Ed's got that ride.
Davey Hamilton, that's the one I'm
going to
say.
Yeah,
Davey just does this race.
Yeah, yeah. But it's going to be interesting. I mean, Elio Castroneves, he's not used to starting in the sixth row.
Well, he's having a terrible year.
Yeah.
I don't know what's gone on. There's something wrong in his head. And I don't mean like crazy or sick or something, but I just think he's lost his edge this year.
Well, something's not right. But, you know, people say who's going to win. Well, I mean, obviously any of the Penske or Ganassi drivers are still, you know, going to be there.
Got to be the favorites going in.
Yeah. Taglioni can win.
Yes,
he's a smart, talented driver. Townsend Bell is another one in the inside of row two. He's really good at the speedway. But when you have Scott Dixon in the middle of the front row, you know, we'll see. I hope they don't have a big wreck at the beginning. I hope it stays green the first 25 laps, and then we'll see. That's a good first 25 laps. You'll get a good idea.
Okay, so we're going to have to take a break here in a second, but I'll put you on the spot. No, I'll put myself on the spot. Who's going to win?
I'm going to say Dario Franchitti wins his third Indy 500.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going with Will Power only because the guy has been so dominant so far this season.
Yeah.
And I think he's in the zone, and he's the best positioned of the Penske drivers right now. So that's where my money is right now. Although, that's my prediction, I'd be happy with a lot of other drivers.
Oh, I'd be happy with a lot of drivers. I'd actually like to see Danica be the first woman to win.
I think it'd be so awesome for her to win on the 100th anniversary.
And awesome for the sport.
Yeah.
I mean, the media attention would be, after all this horrible news with the tornadoes and stuff, it would be nice to have that sort of a...
Yeah, it'd be really cool. Well, Peter, we're going to have to cut you loose so you can get down to Indianapolis.
Yeah, so I'll be glad to go, and we'll talk about it maybe a little next week.
Cool, and then we'll get Russ Clark and Todd Lassa in here. But now we've got to thank one of our great sponsors for bringing you this show. And here's a message from Bridgestone. Bridgestone is featuring its third generation of run-flat tires with groundbreaking new technology. Current run-flat tires can offer peace of mind for consumers, but the added mass and the stiffer sidewalls can compromise ride comfort and fuel efficiency. The new third-generation Bridgestone run-flat tires reduce heat and improve performance and ride comfort. Whether you're a program manager in the industry or just looking for a set for your personal car, check it out at BridgestoneTire.com. Well, we lost Peter DeLorenzo, but we just gained Russ Clark and Todd Lassa. And Russ, great to have you in here talking all about marketing and certain products at Chevrolet. Tell us which ones you specifically concentrate on here.
Well, first of all, thanks, John, for having me. It's great to be here. At Chevrolet, I got the great pleasure to work on some really cool stuff. We've got Camaro and Corvette on my teams and a new Malibu that we're going to be launching here in a few short months, and as well as Impala. So I've got fun stuff and a lot of good business stuff, too. So.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I got to officially welcome more warmly here Todd Lassa from Motor Trend Magazine. Great having you back here,
John,
Todd.
Always good to be here.
And Motor Trend Classics, too. In fact, Todd just brought us in the latest issue of that, and it looks terrific.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I'm kind of proud of that when I got the cover story on the 1959 Cadillac Cyclone.
And tell the viewers a little bit about that car, because it's
Cadillac Cyclone,
not well known.
Yeah, well, it was designed at the very end of the Harley Earl regime and actually ushered in the beginning of the Bill Mitchell regime. It also became the car that that Ed Welburn saw when he was a kid and decided, I want to be a car designer. The car is a two-seat Cadillac, but it has it's a large car for a two-seater, and it's got a bubble top, a lot of future stuff.
Very low slung.
Very low slung. Go see Motor Trend Classic and pick up a copy, and I think it's a good story. Just the story of how Ed Welburn is still involved with that car. I was able to talk to him for the article. Also wrote about the 44 Willys MB, the 70th anniversary of the Jeep, and that was fun, too. A lot of good stuff in that issue.
Yeah. Good-looking book there.
Thank you.
Well, Russ, let's talk Chevrolet. I mean, Todd just mentioned the 70th anniversary of the Jeep. Chevrolet is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year.
Absolutely. It's our 100th anniversary. Started in 1911, right, with Louis Chevrolet and William Durant forming Chevrolet Company, you know, based a lot on racing to start with Louis Chevrolet, but always putting together a company and a business that's founded on, you know, value and performance and excitement and that sort of thing. So 100 years of that to celebrate, as well as looking forward to where we're going in the future.
And going next year to Indy, and yep. So you guys are making a big splash at Indy this year. It's 100th anniversary, your 100th anniversary?
We're sharing that with Indianapolis this weekend. Their 100th, our 100th. The Camaro will pace the Indy 500 for the seventh time this year for Camaro, the 22nd time for Chevrolet throughout that history. And we created a special edition for that pace car that's kind of reminiscent of the iconic 1969 Camaro pace car with a white and orange color scheme.
And, of course, A.J. Foyt's driving the pace car. I'm sure you guys are glad he's driving it, not Donald Trump, who was originally scheduled to be.
We all wanted to see what would happen to his hair if he drove the car,
And, you know, A.J. was really more associated with Ford in most of his career. So I think that's a little bit of a coup for you guys to have A.J. driving your pace car.
We're proud to have him, and we know he'll be able to use what the Camaro can offer, too, in terms of driving around in front of the grid. And, you know, from an overall perspective, Chevrolet's history at Indianapolis and then going next year, as you mentioned, John, with a all-new Chevrolet engine, 2.2-liter twin-turbo V6, working together with Ilmor Racing to develop the engine, and then, of course, Penske being our first team to sign up for it. So we're excited for
it. Oh, is that right? I wasn't aware of that Penske already signed up for that. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah. Looking forward to it, and it's great to see Chevy back in there. It would be nice to see that series become multiple engines again, and I'm sure you'd like to see that as well.
Well, I think it'd be interesting. Well, certainly we're glad. We've got a great history with it. I think six champions in Chevrolets over the years, and I think it's great for the fans, too, and generate a lot more interest in the—
Sure it is. I mean, you know, look, we're really glad that Honda was in there because it carried the water
there. It did.
Nobody else was around. But I think even Honda really wants others in there. It doesn't want to race against itself.
Mm-hmm. Competition's always good.
It is.
Competition's always good.
Well, and you know, the argument has been made for a long, long time, how valuable is racing to selling, you know, race on Sunday, win on Sunday, sell on Monday. And you're coming out of a period where, of course, GM had to restructure, go through bankruptcy. You had a couple of lean years, and, of course, now you're working on a lot of new product for the next few years. But how hard was the decision for GM to say, okay, we're going to, at this point, just a few years after things looked so dismal, at this point get back into a very expensive but a very high-profile kind of racing?
Well, I think from an overall perspective, in racing, it's all about learning how to make better cars, better engines and technology as we continue to go forward to get every bit of power and as well as fuel efficiency out of engines. Racing allows you to work on a lot of things that help us do that. And then, of course, it's a way to reach customers, too. Like with Corvette and our ALMS racing with the Corvette, we take what we learn in racing and apply it to the production cars and then vice versa. So I know you had Doug and Doug Feith.
Yeah, Doug Feith we had in here last year, right?
Yeah, a while back. And it's really true. We race to make a better production car, and our production car helps us make a better race car, too.
But can you give us a little insight? Was there a lot of internal discussion and argument? Was there a big faction that said, no, we can't do this now?
I think it becomes, you know, we've created a whole group now called Motorsports under Jim Campbell. So
sure.
I think it's a big emphasis and effort now to to say, look, a real car company and a major force in the car company needs to touch all bases. So, India has been something with great heritage and something we really believe is a strong program for us to get back into. As far as what went on, I'm sure there was a lot of discussion, Todd, in a number of rooms, and we have to make a good business decision wherever we do. So all that went into it.
So obviously it's a good business decision because you're getting back in.
We believe so,
Let's talk about some new product you guys got coming up.
Yeah.
You teased us by showing us the new Malibu at the New York Auto Show this year. What are the plans for this car? I mean, Malibu's been going pretty strong. Yep. This is the strongest Malibu in a long time, the current one. What do you plan to do with the next gen that's coming? When is that, next year?
Early next year, first quarter next year, we will launch with an all-new Malibu, starting out with what we call the Eco model, which will have the e-Assist technology in it. We're estimating 27 miles per gallon city, 38 highway with that car. So launching again with the newest technology and the highest fuel economy into a segment. The styling, the way we talk about the car is you're going to feel great walking up to it. You're going to enjoy sitting in it. Well, styling on walking up to it, it's got a lot of Camaro.
I was going to say, there are definitely Camaro design cues in this new design.
It's sportier than today's. Today's a more elegant-looking Malibu. This one takes a little sporty. It's wider. It's got a wider footprint. Then you sit in. The interior is just amazing with the quality of the materials and the infotainment. We'll have the 7-inch color touch screens in there with Pandora and Stitcher capability. Then when you drive it, the ride and handling, we think should surprise a lot of people with the car. And then when you own it, too, we've got our warranty, the 5-year, 100,000-mile warranty, and the level of quality that's in the car. So we like to say whoever buys it's going to be the happiest guy on the street.
You know, I always thought that the current generation Malibu should be doing better than it has. What is it? Why is it that that car didn't catch on like I think it should have? And what are you going to do with this next generation to bump sales up even more?
I would say I think it has caught on. And it's kind of catching on that I like. We've had 3 years of increased sales and increased market share in a very competitive segment. You know, a couple of those years were tough years, both for the industry as well as GM. And to still to post increased sales and share with the car, we think it's a great testament to how good it is. So 3 years in a row, and this year we're ahead of last year, too. So it could very easily be 4 years in a row of increased share and increased sales volume on the car. Like I said, very competitive segment. Things we'll do on the next car to even take it to that next level. While this car, when it came out, I think set some styling, blew some people away with some styling, both inside and out. I think we'll do that again. But we'll add a lot more technology in the car, this time from an infotainment perspective, and more fuel economy, too.
You know, the current generation car, to me, seemed to be designed, if you will, more European-like. In fact, almost Volkswagen-like, whereas the next generation, definitely an American-style car.
It's got the face of Chevrolet, the global face, and it is a global Chevrolet now. We'll sell this car in almost 100 countries as a Chevrolet Malibu. With that kind of footprint, it'll help Chevrolet continue to grow globally. We sold a little over 4.2 million cars last year globally for Chevrolet. That's delivering one about every 7.5 seconds on average around the world.
He's got the facts at his fingertips.
Well, you know, speaking of the facts, you've done pretty well with the current Malibu, and it's really a tough act to follow, and especially when you look at what Malibu was a couple of generations, the two generations before that, and how far it's come, and now it's kind of an incremental leap next. But it seems like you've gone for kind of splitting up the segment between, if I look at monthly sales, the slightly larger Chevy Impala mm-hmm. and the Chevy Malibu have kind of traded places in terms of numbers at mm-hmm. Chevrolet almost every month going back many years. Of course, the Impala does more fleet now than the Malibu does. But I wonder if you had done less emphasis on the Impala, whether the Malibu might have, you know, kind of sprung into the same sort of numbers that we see from Toyota Camry and Honda Accord, the top sellers in the category.
Well, we'll do right around 200,000 Malibus this year. And I know Toyota and Honda have traditionally done much more than
about
that.
Twice that, yeah.
Well, if we look at where the segment's gone, it's very competitive, mm-hmm. Much more so than it was 5 years ago. We were kind of the first mover to move up into that category of real competitor to Honda and Toyota. We've been followed quickly by a couple of our close colleagues, Ford and Nissan, and they've all moved up. So, and that time, the shares of Honda and Toyota have come down, and it's all kind of congealing in this. Everybody, it's almost like the European market. There's six major players, and Malibu is one of the key ones there, that do about 80% of the midsize segment.
Right? And I find it interesting, too, that you're following Hyundai into being, I think, maybe the second among all those major players in offering only a four-cylinder with the next Malibu, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
I think that's where the whole industry is heading.
Right.
But can you talk about that a little bit?
We'll have a new family of four-cylinder engines, a 2.5 liter.
That's a pretty big four.
Yep, a little over 190 horsepower and 188, I think, is the torque on it. So the performance of the car will be extremely good, actually pretty close to this year's V6, okay, with the four-cylinder, and that's with the fuel economy in the low to mid-30s for a highway. The Eco model is a 2.4 liter, 180 horsepower, so plenty of oomph there, too. With an additional 12 horsepower with the electronic motor generator. So the four-cylinders themselves, and the segment really is about 85-90% four-cylinder, always has been. We have a family of four-cylinders, and we think it's the right move for this segment.
You know, Todd made mention of two generations ago Malibu, which in my book was not a pleasing car to look at.
God,
you know,
yeah.
Wasn't that it was bad, but it wasn't, like, pleasing. And General Motors has got a history of when a car does bad in the market, not just GM, mm-hmm. I would say Ford and Chrysler, too. When a car does bad in the market, whoop, drop that name. Mm-hmm. It's earned itself a poor image. Yet you've stuck with the Malibu name. Why?
Well, it's always argument, if you will, what to do. There's an awful lot of equity built up in the Malibu name. We found that the name itself always still conjures up a very positive relationship with consumers and the brand. And it also, you want to get the momentum and continue to build it in the car. So it wasn't a hard decision to keep Malibu on, even when we went to the new one, the current model. There was discussion, yeah, should we call it something else? But then you look at what does that cost to seed a name and get the awareness up there.
So what's the cost? If you got to put a new name in the marketplace, how many tens or hundreds of millions of dollars do you have to spend to establish that name in the consumer's mind?
What did it cost for Cruise, for example?
I don't have the numbers, but let's just put it in the range of a good Powerball, jackpot. So that's about where you got to spend, and it's over time. So.
So several hundred million dollars you're talking about.
It could be.
Wow.
Yeah. Including all the marketing going forward, well into the cycle of the car. Yeah, sure.
And I think overall a good car is really what's really important in terms of that. And a good car will help a name, and a name that won't necessarily help a bad car. So we're very pleased. We've got a lot of great cars to put our names on these days.
Hey, we've got to take a quick commercial break, and wouldn't you know it, we're going to get a message here from our great friends at Chevrolet, and we thank you for sponsoring this program. Not only does the Chevrolet Cruze offer a ton of features, it features some of the best safety and maintenance in the business. The Cruze comes with rear park assist, which beeps if you're about to back into something. It has rollover mitigation, which means the car senses if it might roll over and applies the brakes to the outside front tire to bring the car back under control. and it has OnStar vehicle diagnostics, which sends you emails about the latest status of your car. And you can learn a lot more about it at Chevrolet.com/cruise. Russ, we've been talking about the Malibu here. General Motors announced this week that it's also going to be putting the new Chevy Impala in the Hamtramck plant. So tell us a bit about this car, too, because the current version's been around a long time. It's been tweaked over the years. Selling very well, but mainly as a fleet car. What are your plans with the Impala going forward?
Well, we've announced, as you said, that we're going to build the car in Hamtramck. That's about as far as we're going these days on talking about it. I can tell you, we think it'll be a really exciting car. The current car has done well for us. It has gone on a fairly long life cycle for a large car, but it's doing very well in its segment. Yes, it does do a lot of fleet cars, but that's because the fleets demand it. They want the larger car with the trunk and the good gas mileage. So it's a great car for them. It's also a great value for the retail customer. And we're doing, you know, $4,000 to $5,000 a month on average with the car. So that's not
in retail.
Retail, it's
right?
Not a small or insignificant number.
Right, but close to $20,000 or so, all in.
All in, right?
So, but you've got some tweaks coming for it next year, right?
Oh yeah, yes. For the 12 Impala, we're putting in the high-feature V6, 3.6 liter. It'll get just a little over 300 horsepower in the car and 30 miles per gallon highway. So while cars continue to have great value and even improving the car as it sits right now. So we're excited about that. A couple little tweaks on grills and that sort of thing to make a little bit of difference in the look. But it's been a great car to drive, and that'll be more fun, too.
And you've got Camaro and Corvette as well, you mentioned.
Yeah.
So Camaro has gone to the head of the class here. It's easily outselling the Mustang and the Dodge Challenger as well.
Well, you know, it's got a great heritage and a great following, but the car is just a blast. I'm driving one now. I've got a Camaro convertible and I drive around, and it's just fun. Like, you know, last night as I checked out of the garage, I love your car. You know, it's great. So. We have our largest web enthusiast club, Camaro 5. They do fan fests, and the people that come just to talk about Camaro. So this year we brought the convertible out. We announced the ZL1 product coming early next year, and we showed that in Chicago, a supercharged Camaro. So everybody's excited about that coming. So we just want to keep the excitement up around Camaro and keep it building. Like I said, nobody's in a sales race. We're very happy to sell the number that we do, though.
Well, and the heritage of that car is actually that, frankly, over all the years, I think, except for one or two years, Ford Mustang has beat it in sales since the 67 Camaro, maybe 82, and might have beat Mustang in the first or second year or something. But what's happening here? Why are you staying ahead of Mustang? I mean, they have not stood still either. Nope. Ford has upgraded that car and done a pretty nice job.
Very nice job.
So what do you think's happening?
Well, we're new. We have a great style. It certainly stands out. There aren't as many of them, let's say, as on the road. It's a very competitive car, and I just think it's a car that epitomizes the passion that people have around our brand and around the Camaro especially. So,
but is some of it maybe pent-up demand? Because sure. you pulled the car out of the market for, I can't remember.
2002, I think it was the last.
Okay, year. So, you know, yeah, 8 years, 9 years or something like that. Right. So, I mean, are you just riding a wave now of a bunch of people coming back and then it's going to tail off, or where do you see it going?
Well, certainly there's that element, but things like we did with the Transformer movies that brought a whole new generation of people, the younger people that saw the movies, saw the vehicle in Transformers, and now that's become a great vehicle for a new generation of people. So we'll continue to have that feed it. We'll continue to bring out new and exciting things for the car. Like the special editions, the Indy 500, the Neiman Marcus car we did with it. We have a what we call the Synergy series that we build. It's a combination of accessories and some unique things we do in the plant that allows a customer to buy special products. So everybody, not only they want a Camaro, they want to make it theirs. And we're going to continue to try and make that happen for them.
That's got to be very important because, of course, that segment is known for dropping off after the first year. You point out that it was new and fresh, but typically coupes especially drop off after the first year, year and a half of sales. But
and, you know, the convertible comes in, and, and it, in the segment, that's roughly about 20 to 25% of the sales.
Right.
And we're exceeding that now because of the same thing, pent-up demand. For the convertible, but it'll level out, you know, in that range. But that's 25% we didn't have before.
What's your V6 to V8 take rate on that car?
On the convertible?
Well, no, on the Camaro altogether.
It's about 60% V6.
I'm guessing it's higher on the convertible, right?
Not right now, but we do expect,
but you expect it to be.
It to
be higher.
We do expect it to be. The convertible's following the same pattern the coupe did, which is the enthusiasts are coming out first, the traditional enthusiasts, and the V8, the coupe started out like 60, 65%. Mm-hmm. And it's now, of course, with gas prices and everything too, but our V6 is 312 horsepower, and next year 323. So
do these high gas prices hurt cars like Camaro and Corvette especially?
They haven't hurt Camaro. And Corvette actually has had three relatively good months in a row now for sales. It's showing some renewed strength. And that's more of a segment issue for the Corvette. We're still 30% of that segment. It's not a lot of players, but it's a luxury sports car segment, and we're still the number one player in 30%. And whether the segment's large or small, that seems to be the penetration we always get. So, and we're doing a lot of things with Corvette, too. We have a Centennial Edition coming out, which is, I don't know if you've seen that one.
No, I haven't seen that.
We're putting carbon black or carbon flash, the metallic black paint, and that's it'll be exclusive to that car.
Is this call the satin look or flat black?
No, it's a metallic black.
Okay.
Okay.
And so it's got a gleam or a shine to it.
Well, the red striped wheels with the red calipers, and it's a rather unique looking Corvette. It's generated a lot of attention for us. And that's to celebrate our 100th, help us celebrate our 100th year. Remember, I said we were born out of racing, and what other car would be best to kind of create a 100th anniversary celebration car than a Corvette?
And then you've got a 50th anniversary of the Corvette coming up in not too long.
The following year would be
53,
our 50th year.
So 2013, right?
Would be our 50th
year. 60th, rather. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you're right.
I'm taking 10 years off.
I got a lot of anniversaries. This year's a 45th for Camaro. And we've got one of those, too.
Let me put you on the spot if I could ask you to predict where the heart of the segment is, heart of the market is going to go regarding Chevy Cruze and Chevy Malibu. You know, everybody's been predicting that as gas prices, even before gas prices went up, that the C segment would become the predominant segment for sedans in the United States. Both you and some of your competitors have been saying that. You came out with a competitive C segment car finally, the Chevy Cruze.
Right.
But now you have a new CD Malibu coming out next year, and that has traditionally been the heart of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And you also have higher fuel mileage. And with bumping up the fuel mileage of midsize cars, is $4 a gallon gas going to give the market to the C segment or the CD segment, do you think?
I think both segments will benefit. I think the C might see more growth because it started out on a little bit smaller base.
You think CD will remain the predominant segment, though?
I think so. I mean, that's where the heart of the customer market is. If you look at the demographic and you say, what's the average new car buyer, and then you look at the demographics of the mid-sized car buyers, I mean, they're almost identical. So so that's still the bulk of the market. The C may grow a little bit more, at least my perspective, just because it starts out smaller. And as people decide, and they're saying, I'm looking for more fuel economy in my next vehicle, and people manage their household fleets where they might have had two large vehicles before. Now they have one, and then they'll go out and buy a smaller car.
And car prices are going up.
Car prices?
Will that affect that at all, do you think?
Sure. People have to stay in budgets, too.
Yeah.
So they'll look for the most they can get for what they have available to them to spend on their transportation budget. And fuel economy plays a part in that, as well as the car payment, of course.
Yeah.
And cars, yes, they are getting more expensive. The technology required to hit the fuel economy targets, everything we're putting into them, and all the new features, too, that people want in cars.
You get a nicely equipped C car for what you used to pay for, a kind of nicely equipped CD car, but more equipment now with all the electronics.
But right now, like with Cruise in Malibu, we talked about Malibu's, you know, 3-4 years in a row, Cruise has come in and kind of looks like it's starting to repeat that, where Chevrolet's come into a very competitive segment and now is doing very, very well in it. And that both cars are complementing each other. Mm-hmm. So we're having record Malibu months, as well as the Cruise is like hitting it out of the park for us.
They're almost selling in identical numbers now, at least in the last month.
Cruises, for a couple months, we're about the same. Cruises, actually, we're selling a few more Cruises, but everybody's happy about that, especially the dealers and us.
And is Cruise higher retail percentage or versus Malibu?
Right now, yeah.
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 But you expect, obviously, that'll change with the new Malibu.
Sure. Sure.
Hey, let's get to our viewer questions,
okay.
But we got to take another break right now, and we really want to thank Hyundai for sponsoring this show. The sixth generation of the Hyundai Sonata is taking the industry by storm, and no wonder. It offers a fluidic design theme that gives it a strikingly modern, coupe-like exterior design, and yet the interior provides the roominess of a full-size car as measured by the EPA. The Sonata also provides an eco-friendly interior with soy-based foam for the seats. Put it all together with Hyundai's strong reliability and value proposition, and you've got yourself a really compelling package. Check it all out at HyundaiSonata.com. Okay, it's time for rapid fire. Ben, let's bring in the music. Okay, Beauregard Jackson writes in to say, why the decision to start manufacturing the Impala in Detroit?
That's a great question. Everything we look at is always on the manufacturing footprint. You know, where's the best place to do it? Clearly, Detroit's our home. It's a flagship car for us, so that's kind of a nice fit. But there's a lot of decisions that go into where to build the car, and we're just happy to be able to say we can do it here in Detroit and add up to 2,500 jobs.
Yeah, and it's also being made in Oshawa, Canada. It's going to be built in both places now. Do you see that much demand for the car?
Certainly, we hope to do very well with the car. Like I mentioned before, large corporations like to buy cars, and they like Impalas, so there's always demand there. And we've always done extremely well coming out with the new one. And we're excited about the new one, but that's about all I'll say about it.
Okay. Right. Jay Cujo wants to know, will the current Camaro be killed or will it have a next generation?
Well, we're certainly planning on the next generation. We brought the Camaro back to stay, so that is our plan.
George from Brooklyn wants to know, what platform will the new Impala ride on?
We haven't talked about any of the elements of the car yet, but I'll just continue to say we're very excited about
it. For that. We've had a little bit on the car.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? What are you guys saying, Todd?
Well, Epsilon 2, but a stretched, maybe bigger than the Buick LaCrosse, and so with V6 and V6 power, obviously.
Yeah, front-wheel drive.
And front-wheel drive, yes.
Okay, George from Brooklyn wants to know, oh, no, that's the one I just read. Unsprung wants to know, will you also use the Kansas plant to make Malibus?
Yes.
Okay. Greg says, I've driven the Cruise and came away very impressed, but reviewers seem to be continually complaining about two things. They say the 6-speed auto is reluctant to downshift and is set too far forward towards fuel economy, and that the 1.4 turbo engine just doesn't produce enough power for the weight of the car.
Hmm. I'll be glad to take that knowledge or the comments back to our team that works on Cruise. I haven't spent a lot of time in the car yet. I've been focusing. I get a chance to drive Corvettes and Camaros. So,
so why drive a Cruise?
Yeah. But it's like I said, the car's done extremely well. The 6-speeds are always, you know, there's more shifting going on. So, and we do, just like every other car, we have to focus as much as we can on fuel economy when we put them together. So
it's done very well. We I think we like the car overall, but some of my colleagues have complained about the power as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, I see we got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
John's from San Diego. I was wondering if the new Malibu LT trim level is going to have standard fog lights and alloy wheels to match the Ford Fusion and the Hyundai Sonata out here that are selling very well in California. I can tell you from firsthand experience of actually selling cars that fog lights and alloys make a big difference at this trim level. And the sales will increase quite a bit on the Malibu if you do that. And there's no problem putting the price of the options on the sticker. Nobody was going to blink about another $100 to $300 on the sticker. Well, $500 if you add the alloys on the sticker. Your thoughts? Thanks.
Sure. We'll have three trim levels on the car, LS, LT, and LTZ. LT will have the alloys.
And fog lamps?
Fog lamps, if I'm correct, I think yes, or it may be the first package you get, will, and everything above that will include the fog lamps.
May I just say, I like fog lamps, but don't use them when it's not foggy. They're for fog.
They're for fog.
Yeah.
But apparently people just like the look of them, whether they're on or not, right?
That's fine, as long as they're not on when it's not foggy.
Okay. Comment from Tony G. He wants to know, Russ, can you tell us if we'll ever see a 3.6-liter option in the Equinox? The fuel economy for the current 3-liter V6 is about the same, but it is substantially less powerful than the 3.6.
Yeah. No plans I know of at this point to put the 3.6 in the Equinox.
Okay. Goggles Pisano wants to know, he says the Cobalt had an SS edition, which was clearly the high-performance version of the model. With the Cruze competing in touring car championships in Europe, why is there not a high-performance street version that would reflect this?
That's an excellent question.
I agree.
The car came out and focused on getting into the mainstream of the compact car segment, and with a focus on fuel economy at this time. So,
I've seen an
RS version of the vehicle, which right now is a little bit more looks than the
more show than go.
I've seen you guys go back and forth on whether every model should have an SS version, and the last I heard a few years ago was only on the Sirius mm-hmm. performance versions. Yeah, if you don't have a performance engine in the car, shouldn't be an SS.
We have internal requirements in order to call it an SS,
right.
And they're all around stop, turn, go, and to make sure that it isn't just speed or fast speed. It's got to stop and it's got to turn and
right.
as well as go. So if we can do it and it makes good business sense, we can pursue that. But if we don't think we can do it and or make good business sense, then it becomes a little more difficult.
I see a tie-in with that 2.2-liter turbo Indy engine.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
There you go.
That would do it.
Okay. Interesting aftermarket.
That would be.
Great. Okay, we got a question coming in from Facebook from Pedro Craig, who wants to know if GM's developing e-assist for its future V8s.
Again, a good question. A lot of the focus, again, will be on four cylinders and in gaining the best fuel economy you can out of the vehicle. So I don't know of any plans to put e-assist on V8s, but that's me. I don't know of any. Okay.
Okay, and let's see here. What else do we've got? Here's a question. Where is the G8 or any rear drive four-door car at GM? Why does GM continue to ignore this important part of the market that wants rear drive?
Well, we have where the G8 was produced, Holden. We are now importing the Caprice police car.
Police car, right.
Become a cop.
Become a cop. There you go. There's always interest in wherever there's market opportunity for us, there's interest. So,
well, fuel economy standards are going to get a lot stricter going forward. Does that kill rear drive for passenger cars?
I don't think it necessarily kills rear drive, but because there's a lot of technologies you can put in the cars to improve it, they'll probably never. Mass is really the killer for fuel economy. So, if you can continue to make lightweight architectures and rear wheel drive, you can continue to do that. So.
Okay, let's see what else we've got here. Jacob wants to know, will the C8 Corvette really have a hybrid powertrain as its main drivetrain, as Peter DeLorenzo thinks, and will the V8 be relegated to special orders?
Oh, that's interesting. That's a lot of speculation there.
I think he's talking about the C7, right?
Well, this says C8.
C8.
Okay.
C7 is just...
We haven't done C7 yet, so...
We haven't seen the C7 yet, but my understanding is that's a substantial redo of the current platform, and the C8 is where it really starts to change.
Well, we're not here, I guess, necessarily to talk about that kind of future product.
How about that, Malibu, right?
How about that, Malibu? Yeah, but I will tell you, the current Corvette, like I say, doing very well, and... lots of exciting things here for its next couple of years. I know, as you know, Mark Royce was down in Bowling Green last week, I believe, and did announce the investment there to do the next generation Corvette. So this is a strong future for it. That's about as much as I can say about the future cars.
There was a report on the internet this morning. I think the Detroit Bureau broke it about what engine was being designed for the next C7. I have to say, I don't believe it, but can you talk about that at all? Do you know what I'm talking about? The turbocharged 3-liter overhead cam V8?
Yeah.
I'd like to hear someone just say, no, that's ridiculous, because I think it is.
So, why so, Todd?
Well, because I don't think GM's ready to put that kind of money into an all-new engine yet. And that would have to be an engine that not only serves the Corvette, but obviously you'd have to consider that for Cadillacs. It's possible. Maybe they're going to do it. I would be surprised to see it just a few years after GM canceled its last overhead cam V8 engine program.
Well,
a non-committal from...
Yeah, right. Right.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the...
Not confirm or deny. Okay. All right, so.
The hybrid, some sort of hybrid powertrain in the VET. When we had Mark Royce on the show, he said at least when it comes to trucks, it's when you look down in the post-2016 timeframe, he was saying in trucks... It's awfully hard to do without some sort of electrification in the car, some sort of battery boost to the whole thing. I got to believe the same would be true of a sports car like the VET.
Well, again, mass is another key thing. Of course, with a truck, mass also begets capability at times, too.
You have to look at the volumes, too.
Yeah, and the volumes that, because of the way the numbers
are calculated. I mean, Cafe sell billions of trucks, but not Corvettes.
So we know Americans love their trucks, too. So we have to continue to find a way to comply and do the right thing and make the trucks do everything they've always done, as well as get better fuel economy. And the standards are tough. And when you get into, like I said, the smaller volume cars, and it's also mass, like I said. So a Corvette doesn't weigh anywhere near as much as a full-size pickup. So you can do some things, and it's got a little better aero too than a full size pickup. So
think of all the Corvettes that the Chevy Volt can offset in Cafe.
Yeah. Right. We've got some more phone calls here, Ben. Let's bring one in.
Hi, this is Dan from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and I have a question regarding the weight of American cars, Chevrolets. They do tend to be 200 to 300 pounds heavier when you look at their Asian and sometimes European counterparts, and I just wondered how quickly that gap will be closed. Thank you.
And I would add, not just European and Asian too. I mean, Camaro's the pretty heavy compared to the Mustang.
Yeah, well, Camaro's to Dan's point, there is 280 pounds, I think, and part of that is the fact that we. And again, as it all gets in engineering, you engineer bigger wheels, you have to have some mass for that, and the car's just bigger, than the Mustang. So that's about half and half.
But GM does have heavy vehicles.
And we do, and it's something we're working on very hard for even the current cars as well as the future cars, again, because what drives it, again, is fuel economy. We tend to want to make our cars as good and strong and structurally safe and everything as possible, and we're just going to continue to work on that.
Yeah, actually, and I'm not trying to be an apologist for GM, but it's amazing that you guys get the fuel economy you do with the weight penalty that you're carrying.
Yeah, well, the next new Malibu will be lighter than the current one.
And again, that gets back to committing to just a four-cylinder engine.
Well, yeah, because current one carries a mass in the front to carry a V6 as well as a four. That's another reason to go to fours is so that the architecture, the structure of the vehicle can be sized specifically for that.
I think Hyundai said that they saved 150 pounds. Is that a right number
for the
Sonata?
On the Sonata?
Of committing? Can it be that much of a weight savings?
Depends where you start, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it does.
Depends on what your engines are, for one thing.
Right.
What about high-strength steel? Is it becoming more economically viable for mainstream Chevrolets, or do you still have to be judicious in how much you use?
Well, again, we balance everywhere cost and mass as the two key drivers. We could probably develop cars that even do much better fuel economy and much more safer, but nobody could afford them. We've got great engineers that give them the challenge, and they'll figure out how to do things. But the high-strength steel and the steel industry continues to evolve, too, and come up with things that help us. So it's just an ongoing effort everywhere.
Does this new Malibu have more high-strength steel than the current one?
I can't tell you for sure. I don't know the numbers on it, but it is lighter, it's faster, and better fuel economy. You know, all the kinds of things you like to talk about when you bring out a new car.
Better, better, better.
Better, better, better. And as good as the new one is, I think we'll even be better. And that's the other thing in that segment is, like I said, it's very competitive. And you almost have to get in your head, I got to go as far as I can and then another step further in order to continue to improve your position in it. If all we're doing is playing catch-up, we know where we start then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is in the back.
Hey, we've got another phone call here. Ben, bring it in.
My name is John Dunlap. Mm-hmm. I'm from the Missouri Ozarks. And I want to know, is GM going to go in for more all-wheel drive vehicles? They are a godsend for us living in the Deep Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And good question. What about all-wheel drive? Where do you see that going, Russ?
Well, certainly in we do an excellent job in our utilities, our compact utilities. Cars, I think it's fair to say that all-wheel drive, especially as the market continues to shift, can play a bigger role. We still haven't seen huge demand for it here in many of the car classes, but in mid and larger cars, there's a potential role for it.
More in the luxury end, would you say, though?
More when you do rear-wheel drive as opposed to front-wheel drive. Right.
Yeah, but I think all-wheel drive still will play a future. But again, it adds mass.
Yeah.
It adds significant cost, too. So, but you're right. It's easier in the rear-wheel drives, at least with today's architectures.
Good scent of winter tires will go a long way.
Yes, they will. Yeah. Boy, I've always said, if I had to choose between all-wheel drive or snow tires in the winter, I'll take the snow tires over all-wheel drive. I mean, I want both. But if that's my choice, I'll take the snow tires. It makes a dramatic difference.
Right.
We got another call. Ben, let's bring him in.
Hey, guys. Good evening. This is Youngblood, Cleveland, Ohio.
All right.
A couple things. If you guys make a hot rod cruise, I got the name for it, and you can have the name. Call it the cruise missile.
Cruise missile. Okay.
And my second question is, before GM hit that bankruptcy, they were supposedly developing a state-of-the-art diesel. I guess it was all aluminum. I don't know if it was a V6 or a V8, but it was ultra-high-tech and state-of-the-art everything. Is there a chance that that thing is still going, and might we see it in something in the future? Thank you. Have a good evening. Bye.
Okay. Well, thanks. I'm not particularly involved in that engine or anything in particular. The diesels are always an opportunity because they do generate about 20% more efficiency, but they also cost quite a bit more. And with the emission rules in the future, it's almost prohibitive from a buying the car perspective as we go forward. So diesels can play a role. It's something we've always said at GM. There is no one answer. to the issues that we face as foreign fuels and greenhouse gas. There's a lot of technology that answers. Diesels can play a role in that.
But GM did develop what everybody's been raving about.
The truck engine.
The truck engine.
Yeah.
So. And which had the exhaust coming out of the V, right, and the intake coming off the outside of the banks. And I never got to drive the engine myself, but I have heard that a lot of people have just been raving about the thing. And I guess that program was killed as the company went into bankruptcy, or even before that, as things started to melt down.
Well, and there was some talk a few months ago, and I didn't follow it perhaps as closely as I should have. And was it either Tom Stevens or Mark Royce or someone made some comments where he said that we're looking at it again, or we're going to get back into it again. I don't think it was definitive.
Right. It's fully developed.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of just tooling it up and putting it in production should the company decide that's the way to go.
Right. But that's still a lot of money right there.
It is a lot of money. But there was a report that leaked out earlier this year that you guys are going to put a diesel in the Cruise in the U.S. market because, of course, you've got it in markets elsewhere in the world. When Mark Royce was on the show, we asked him about it, and he said, we never released that. Well, it was somebody at the Lordstown plant where the car is built. You know, because the union learns about stuff before it goes into production. They want to know, are there going to be jobs? And so it sounds to me like you guys are looking at doing a diesel. And as you know, a V6 or a V8 diesel, You're looking at $3,000 plus in emissions equipment.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a four-cylinder, small, 2-liter or less, you can get by with a whole lot less cost.
Still after treatment.
Still after treatment. But again, you know, in 2014, as Europe goes to Euro 6 emissions, and before we bump up to the next tier 2 bin, whatever it is, U.S. and European emission standards start to overlap. There's a sweet spot there for a number of years where I think the volume of manufacturing for the emission standards and all that emissions equipment is going to bring down the costs. So I guess I'm throwing out a bunch of things saying, what about diesels, Russ?
That all sounds good. I had the great opportunity in my career at GM to actually live and work in Europe. And, you know, I became a diesel fan. I love driving them. I'd love to see us come up with one, but I'm not making any official announcements either.
Yeah.
The president didn't make them. So.
Well, you know, BMW says in the U.S., by the end of this decade, half of all its vehicles are going to be diesels.
Mm-hmm.
I find that an amazing statistic.
Half of them here in the U.S.?
Half in the U.S.
They have a price range that can absorb that, of course.
It can, but I'm also told that Volkswagen has tooled its Chattanooga plant that after the second refresh of the Passat that's coming out of that plant, it can go as high as 80% diesel.
And so, 43 mpg for a large mid-sized car on the highway is what the VW Passat gets.
Sure.
So,
and I'm sure the diesel guys aren't sitting on their hands. I'm sure they're going to figure out ways of taking cost out of meeting those emission standards. So,
They're good engineers, and they love a challenge.
There you go.
Russ isn't talking.
Yeah, I know he's not. That's why we keep pushing him to see what we can get him to break on here.
Right.
Hey, look, we ought to wrap it up. We're at the top of the hour. Couple of things here. We got 4 signed copies of Bob Lutz's new book, and we're going to give one away for free every Friday in June. And here's how you can enter the contest to be able to win one of those signed books of Bob Lutz's. You know, our television program, Out of Line Detroit, is now available to every public television station in the country. In fact, well over 30 stations have picked up the show since the beginning of the year. So if you want to win a book, we want you to send an email to your local public television station saying that you'd love to see them put Out of Line on their lineup, and then send us an email, a copy of that email. We're going to pick it out at random from those emails, and you can win a signed copy of Bob's book. All the details of how to enter this contest are at bit.ly/Out of Line Contest, and that's bit.ly/Out of Line Contest. And So anyway, I really want to thank all you guys for coming on here, Russ and Todd as well. In fact, we want to remind our viewers that you can follow us at facebook.com/outofline Detroit. You can follow us at Twitter at twitter.com/outofline. Follow Peter at autoextremist.com. Russ, where do they go for all their Chevrolet stuff?
Chevrolet.com.
And because you guys are sponsoring us with the cruise, we'll say chevrolet.com/cruise okay. as well. And Todd?
Read me at motortrend.com, Motor City Blog Man, and pick up the magazine if you get a chance.
That's great.
It looks great, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
And thanks, John.
Yeah, no, thanks you guys, and thank all of you for having tuned in.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at autoflinedetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence. Chevrolet, the all-new Chevrolet Cruze. Get used to more. And by Hyundai. Experience the 2011 Hyundai Sonata today at HyundaiSonata.com.